The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Chris Wax, and I'm a supporter of the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm very proud to welcome Joseph J. Ellis back to the Free Library in Philadelphia. He is the Ford Foundation Professor of History at Mount Holyoke College. Mr. Ellis was educated at the College of William & Mary and Yale University. He was Dean of the Faculty at Mount Holyoke for 10 years. In 2001, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Founding Brothers, The Revolutionary Generation. He also earned the National Book Award in 1997 for The American Sphinx, the character of Thomas Jefferson. Now he has written a new and exciting book called American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies, the founding of the Republic. In it, Ellis examines the last quarter of the 18th century, which he considers the most politically creative in American history. It was at a time of both triumphs and tragedies, all of which contributed to the shaping of our expanding nation. Although the founders excelled and creating a nation, Ellis shows how they stumbled in the ways that resonate with us today. Some of the triumphs he identifies are American independence, the creation of the American Republic. In contrast, the glaring failures are tolerance of slavery, the inequality of women, and the brutal treatment of Native Americans. As a master storyteller, Ellis explores the relationship between these triumphs and tragedies through narratives that make history come alive. This Sunday, this book will be number 4 on the bestsellers list. So we're very lucky to have Joe Ellis here tonight. I would like to give him a good welcome to the Philadelphia Free Library.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Boy, it's really a pleasure to be here. I was here once before, a couple years ago, and I tell you, they had this dinner beforehand, and they didn't let you eat. Keep asking you these questions. I will alienate you from the start by suggesting that I come to you from the new capital of sports in the United States, namely New England. Thank you. The Patriots, of course, are undefeated. The Red Sox have won the World Series. And, in fact, the Celtics, though they're playing tonight, are still undefeated. I have a bet with my running partner, a trifecta, and I will lose this bet. But I put up $10, and he puts up $1,000. That we're going to sweep the World Series. I did this before August, and the Super Bowl and the NBA championship. Highly unlikely. What you ought to know, and those of you who are real Philadelphia residents understand this to some extent, that the Quaker influence in Philadelphia has prevented you from a sense of tragedy that's equivalent to the New England Boston sense of tragedy. We know this is temporary, okay? We know that it will soon go back to the normal patterns of despair and failure. So don't deny us this one brief moment of glory and triumph, if you possibly can. I've been writing these books about the late 18th century, and I've gotten a little bit defensive about it. People say, well, Joe, for God's sakes, why don't you move on to something more timely, you know, and modern. And I found myself developing what I would like to call the Willie Sutton defense. Now, how many of you out there know who Willie Sutton was? Now, this is a really good crowd, because let me tell you, most people don't know who Willie Sutton was. Willie Sutton was a very lovable bank robber back in the 1950s who was extraordinarily talented at robbing banks and extraordinarily incompetent in staying out of prison. Willie would rob a bank, and they would catch him, and then they would throw him in. Sometimes he would escape. It was one wonderful escape where he popped up in a manhole cover right next to a police station, and they immediately arrested him again. But this pattern, you know, rob a bank, get arrested, rob a bank, get arrested. So finally, the press people asked Willie, they said, oh, has anybody got a book here?
Give me a copy. I have to read something.
The press said to Willie, like, well, why do you rob banks? And Willie said, because that's where they keep the money. Well, the late 18th century is where they keep the money. I don't mean in royalties terms, although that's turned out to be true, too, in recent years. What I mean is intellectually, it's the mother lode. It's the sort of big bang, the explosion that radiates out in terms of its ideas and its institutions. We currently live under the same basic values and institutions that were established in the late 18th century. We're the only jurisprudent, or only form of jurisprudence where the judges actually say we must look back to the original intent of the framers. Nobody in England says, what did William Pitt think of this? So this is a really important time, and I'm going to not read much from this book. I'm going to read one page. Uh-oh, let me get see if I got my glasses. I had an eye operation in the summer, and now I can't see anything real close, but I can see you perfectly out there. Okay. What is it that they did? This is my most, this is one rendering of what they did. During the last quarter of the 18th century, a former colony of Great Britain, generally regarded as a provincial and wholly peripheral outpost of Western civilization, somehow managed to establish a set of ideas and institutions that over the stretch of time became the blueprint for political and economic success for the nation state in the modern world. Over the course of the next two centuries, these ideas and institutions, labeled democracy or liberalism, though neither term would have been recognizable to the founding generation, replaced the monarchical dynasties of Europe in the 19th century and then defeated the totalitarian despotisms of Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union in the 20th. Before we embark on the stories that follow, and it is a book of stories, we need at least to glimpse the contours of the larger story, which is about the triumph of representative government bottomed on the principle of popular sovereignty, a market economy fueled by the energies of unfettered citizens, a secular state unaffiliated with any official religion, and a rule of law that presumed the equality of all citizens. What seemed so brazen and improbable at the time has become the accepted global formula for national success. The only alternative, apart from North Korea and Cuba's last stand versions of communism, is Islamic fundamentalism. And it's essentially medieval values appear to be fighting a desperate rearguard action against modernity itself. The first enduring version of political modernity in the world made its initial appearance in the United States during the Revolutionary era. That is a big deal. And we need to recognize that. More specifically, I think there were five achievements that were unprecedented, five triumphs that no one at the time thought possible. I'll go off on little tangents on each, but these are the five. We were the first former colony to win a successful war for colonial independence. In the 19th and 20th century, that becomes a more familiar pattern in Africa and Latin America and Asia. But the notion that 13 separate colonies would somehow be able to defeat the most potent naval and military power in the world, think about this. Where between 1750 and 1950 did Great Britain lose? Only once. Against the United States. Now, how in God's name did that happen? I got the answer for you. All you got to do is purchase this wonderful book. Chapter called The Winter that talks about this to some extent. I won't give it all away here. I will say two things, that the greatest threat to American national security in all of American history happens in the fall of 1776. Washington has misguidedly attempted to defend New York, Long Island, and New York. He's got 12,000 smallpox-infested troops against 32,000 Brits and Hessians. They have naval supremacy. At the end of the week, he's down to 3,000. He flees with his 3,000 across the Tappan Zee Bridge before it existed into New Jersey and down into Pennsylvania. Tom Paine, the first embedded journalist, writes the Crisis series then, and it's a famous line, one of the most famous lines in American journalistic history. These are the times that try men's souls. They truly were. If General Howe and his army had chosen to pursue Washington's army at that moment, the war would have been over. All of American history would have changed. I'm not sure. We'd still be independent by now, but in a more evolutionary Australia, Canada kind of way. Why didn't he do it? Why didn't he pursue Washington? There were two reasons. There was some sort of chivalric idea that armies don't fight in the winter, and it was getting cold, going to winter quarters. But there was another reason, and this shows the kind of level of contingency that was such an important factor. There was a woman. Her name was Mrs. Loring. Mrs. Loring was married to a prominent loyalist in New York City, and General Howe wanted to spend the winter with Mrs. Loring, and she wanted to spend the winter with him. And therefore, if we look to seek an explanation for the American success, I tell you, we need to build a monument to Mrs. Loring, who gave everything throughout the winter of 76-77 for the cause. And that's actually a true story. I'm not making that up. There's another dimension. It's somewhat eerie to be writing about the Revolutionary War at the same moment the United States is invading Iraq. And so, like, newspaper people say, you know, like the L.A. Times says, tell us what George Washington would think of Iraq. Well, George Washington wouldn't know where Iraq was, okay? He doesn't know about Humvees and CNN and weapons of mass destruction. So that's, you can't do that. But if you understand the dilemma the British faced in attempting to subjugate a populace. See, Washington thought it was a war of armies first. Our army had to defeat their army. And it was almost honor-bound, he felt, like if Howe or Clinton presented himself, you had to sort of respond. He came to understand 2 or 3 years into the war that it wasn't about, he wasn't just leading an army. He was leading, if you'll excuse the phrase, an insurgency. And that no matter how powerful the British Army, no matter how conventionally competent, no matter the fact that they could take Boston and they did, and they could take New York and they did, and they could take Philadelphia and they did, and they could take Baltimore and they did, and they could take Charleston and they did, they could not, they did not have enough troops to subjugate the population over such a large area. And they wouldn't lose, they would simply decide eventually that it wasn't worth it. And they would withdraw, which is what they did. In some sense, the great insight of Washington was the recognition that the only way he could lose the war was to try to win it. If you think about it, all the great generals that we honor, Hannibal, Napoleon, Robert E. Lee, they're all losers. Washington lost more battles than he won. But he won the war because he understood the larger strategic context in which he was functioning. I've gone off. I'm sorry. I said 5 things. Winning the war is a big deal. Creating a large republic. Up until the American Republic, it was assumed that republican forms of government only functioned in small areas like Greek city-states or Swiss cantons, that a republic was too weak in terms of its power to be able to shape citizens' opinion, and therefore it could only be a small area. The American Republic is the first large-scale republic, and the most ingenious thinker here is Madison. And what Madison basically argues in Federalist 10 is if you increase the size of the republic, you actually increase its stability because you increase the number of factions or interest groups that will interact and will balance each other. It's a kind of marketplace view of political, a pluralistic view of politics that no one had argued before. Most of the European powers presumed that the American Republic was going to dissolve because it was simply incapable of sustaining itself as a republic. And they were all very surprised when that did not happen. It's the first modern state to insist upon the separation of church and state. This is still an idea that in parts of the world is impossible. It's a really, you know, like I get all these evangelicals that call in for talk shows and say, Thomas Jefferson was an evangelical Christian. Actually, he was a deist. There's a moment when after the Constitutional Convention, people come up to Hamilton and they say, how come there's no mention of God in the Constitution? And Hamilton says, why, sir, it never came up. I think the following point is apocryphal, but it's too good a story to completely eliminate. apparently there was a moment in July of 1787, right down the block here, when they're gathered for a discussion of how to decide on representation in the legislature. It eventually becomes by state in the Senate and by proportion in the population in the House. It's a big debate. And of all people, Benjamin Franklin says, perhaps we ought to bring in a chaplain and say a prayer to help us get through this difficult moment. And Hamilton rises and says, sir, I see no reason to call in foreign aid. Though there are still state-supported religious establishments in Massachusetts and Virginia and a couple of other states up until like 1819, 1820, the notion that there, this is the first, see, what had been presumed before is that if you don't have a common religious experience, you don't have the glue that a community requires in order to cohere. And we're saying that's not essential. This is not a Christian nation. This is a secular nation. They're the first modern nation to establish a two-party system. The embryonic version of a two-party system existed in Great Britain, but the full-blown version of it first is implemented in the United States. Parties, political parties, for most of us, have the ring of corruption and negativity, and for a good reason. But think about it this way. The creation of a two-party system disciplines dissent and creates the possibility and then the reality of what's called a legitimate opposition. Instead of when you argue with your opponents in France, if you win, what do? You send them to the guillotine. In the Russian Revolution, when you win, you send them to the firing squad wall. In America, you send them out of power so they can pout and try to figure out how to get back. So that there's a kind of extraordinarily important function that a two-party system performs in creating the possibility of ongoing debate about what the right answers are. No one has all the right answers. They'll be shifting back and forth on issues of federal versus state sovereignty, executive power, etc. Somewhat overlappingly, final point, they create a political culture, a system, in which there is no clear source of sovereignty. Up until, well, from the time of Aristotle onward, it was presumed that any nation state needed to have some final arbiter, some ultimate sovereign source. Indeed, this is what got the British Empire into such trouble with the Americans, because they insisted that the local assemblies in the colonies had to be overridden by a sovereign parliament and king. In the American system created after the Constitution, it's unclear whether the states or the federal government is sovereign. In fact, the finessing of that question is the answer. The creation of an argumentative context in which the answer isn't important, only the argument is important. So that, is the executive sovereign? No. Is the Congress? No. Is the judiciary? Not then. The one thing the Supreme Court was not in the late 18th century was supreme. So that it's an interesting moment, and I think it really is a movement into what we might call political modernity, because it's like there's no one God anymore. there are many gods. And different people will have allegiances to them. These are substantial achievements, it seems to me, and are the reason why this generation of Americans is probably, without much question, the greatest political generation in American history, and why Alfred Lord North Whitehead is probably correct to argue that, great British essayist and philosopher, that in his judgment there are only two occasions in world, or actually he says Western history, when the political elite of an emerging nation state behaves about as well as anyone can possibly expect, reasonably. One is Rome under Caesar Augustus, and the other is the United States under this collection of the founders. How do they do it? One dramatic way to put it, I was in Minneapolis, St. Paul this summer, do a thing at the Guthrie Theater, and just after the bridge fell down, and I noticed that the total population of Minneapolis, St. Paul is 3.1 million. The total white population of the entire United States in the first census in 1790 was 3.1 million. Now, if we went to modern-day Minneapolis, St. Paul, and we walked down the streets, do you think we could find George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, John Marshall, Patrick Henry? Actually, we couldn't. On the other hand, they're there. The latent talent is present. You've got to believe that. But it's not going to come to the surface. It's not going to become discernible and conspicuous. There's something about the social and historic conditions in late 18th century America that drove latent talent to the top, that made Washington, who if he had been in Britain would have never made major in the British Army, that made Adams, who would have never been more than a country lawyer, that made Alexander Hamilton, who literally was a bastard. Actually, Adams thought he was a bastard in several senses of the term. Now, you got to read the book to get all this. But the downside of this, from our point of view, this is a once-in-a-nation's-lifetime experience, okay? Like when Mark Twain arrived at the Holy Land. This is in the book Innocents Abroad. He said, Christ been here once, will never come again. Or Emerson, talking to the next generation, said, don't look back to the founders. Don't look back. Have your own agenda. Because they will blind you. And this is a lovely phrase. He says, they saw God face to face. We can only see him secondhand. Or as Rick Pitino said to the Boston Celtics, Larry Bird is not walking through that door. So it's unfair for us to expect something akin to that in a modern political culture. By the way, none of the founders, as far as I can tell, would have ever run in this political culture. They would have never run for office. They would have regarded as a prostitution of their integrity and a confession that they were unworthy to serve. So we've created that. They would be, I mean, for the rest of you out there, how many of you would ever run for the presidency? I've managed to succeed in this by paying my cleaning lady under the table for 28 years. Therefore, I am totally ineligible to run. though no one has ever asked me either. They did two things brilliantly and one thing badly. They were brilliant about pace. Pacing a revolution. Think about that. Making social change happen at a rate that doesn't implode. Making the American Revolution happen in slow motion, unlike the French and the Russian Revolution. Now, for those of you that believe that justice delayed is justice denied, this is a weak argument. In fact, it's a perverse argument. I believe in it nonetheless. And Adams is the hero in this chapter who recognizes we want to be able to adopt the revolutionary agenda over time, but if we try to implement it right away, it's going to topple the whole enterprise. Space. Pace, space. The obvious space is the Atlantic Ocean. They enjoy a separation from things European. If we were in the middle of Europe, like Poland, we would have never been able to do this. But more than just the ocean, it's, as I suggested about the war earlier, it's the recognition that these spaces of the eastern, you know, half of the United States, or eastern third, represent a scale problem for European powers that they can't negotiate. You cannot dominate this population. And they play that scale problem very well in several moments. Pace, space, race. They really fail on race. They can imagine a secular state. They can imagine a large republic. They can imagine a two-party system. They cannot imagine a biracial society. What we need to remember is the real commitment to a truly biracial society is a mid-20th century American phenomenon. People as committed to anti-slavery as Harriet Beecher Stowe and up until 1863 Abraham Lincoln all believed that when the African Americans were freed, they would have to be deported and sent back to Africa or to someplace in the Caribbean. They just couldn't imagine. Now, if you live in Vermont, you don't have a problem. There's only like 100 African Americans living there. But if you live in Virginia or South Carolina, where it's 40% and 60%, one of the reasons there's a holdout on the slavery issue is the unimaginable consequence of a free black population. This is the first of the great failures. There are two great failures, two tragedies. It's interesting as to whether they are Shakespearean tragedies or Greek tragedies. That is, were they avoidable? Are they a function of human failure and weakness? Or are they the will of the gods? Beyond human control. Sic volvere parcas. Tough question. You can argue those in the terms of the book. On the slavery issue, the numbers tell the basic story. In 1776, there are 500,000 African Americans. In 1800, there are 1.1 million. In 1860, there are 4 million. The founders have done a reasonable job in trying to constrain or contain slavery. They do three things. They end the slave trade, 1808. They prevent the expansion of slavery into the Northwest Territory, the land, the states coming in north of the Ohio River. And all the states north of the Potomac end slavery by 1802. Slavery has become a isolated southern phenomenon. Now, one of the things that's hard to understand, but it's true, Most of the founders thought that slavery was going to die a natural death, that they didn't have to take the kind of concerted action against it because free labor would defeat slave labor. Slavery would just prove to be unprofitable. If we contain it, it will simply be like a cancer that shrivels up and goes into remission and then dies. They didn't foresee the cotton gin. They didn't foresee the cotton kingdom. And therefore, they misunderstood what they were really up against. There are actually three occasions when they face what they're up against squarely. One is in the Continental Congress in July of 76. One is in the Constitutional Convention in the summer of 87. And one is in the First Congress in the spring of 1790. These are the only occasions where there's a direct debate about slavery. And by the way, notice in the Constitution the word slavery is never mentioned, nor is the word African American or Negro or Black. Talk about that species of property. They don't know how to talk about it. They invent these circumlocutions. In all three instances mentioned before, the same thing happens. Georgia, South Carolina, and parts of Virginia say, if you insist on putting slavery on the political agenda, we secede. Now, this is a tough call for the founders, it seems to me. It's not an easy call. It's not like, oh, they're racist and therefore, but it's like, if you insist, are you going to call their bluff? Do you want to destroy the republic at the moment of its birth? Are they really bluffing? Well, they weren't bluffing in 1860. If you actually believe it's going to die, you don't have to call their bluff, see? And this is a toughie. Ellis says there was one final opportunity to end slavery gradually. So no one took it. And in that sense, by suggesting I'm being inherently presentistic, okay, understand, I know that. It's at the Louisiana Purchase. In 1803, we get the Midwest for $15 million, all the land from the Mississippi to the Rockies and the Canadian border to the Gulf. Biggest land deal in American history. Most fertile plot of land on the planet of that size. This is the last shot to do away with slavery along the following lines. Rule that all incoming states out of the territory must, as condition for admission, prohibit slavery. Now, they've done that for the Northwest Territory. Jefferson proposed they do it for all incoming states at one point in time in 1783. Second, we got this for $15 million, right? The total revenue that is accrued, that will accrue to the federal government on the sale of this land is something in excess of $700 million, which back then was real money. Take a portion of that revenue, create an endowment, what they call a sinking endowment. Compensate the white property owners of the South for the release of their slaves. You solve the problem economically. Can you send them all back to Africa? Most of them don't want to go. Becomes a real sticking point, though it never becomes a real sticking point, I guess, because nobody ever tries this. In retrospect, with all the advantage of hindsight, that was the last shot. Once we miss that, it's inevitable that 632,000 Americans are going to die, that three generations of blacks are going to live in slavery. Once we miss that window, And make no mistake, all the founders, all of them, regarded slavery as a permanent stain on their reputation. Nobody said, everybody said, this was a violation of the principles they were fighting for. It's one of the reasons Washington frees all his slaves in his will upon the death of his wife. He wants to get out from under that kind of stigma. The other big failure of equivalent, not quite as great, but close to it, moral horror, is the failure to reach a just settlement with the Native Americans. Got a chapter on this. What happens is clear. The numbers are clear. In 1783, at the end of the war, there are 80,000 Native Americans living between the Mississippi and the Alleghenies. 1790, there are 60,000. In 1800, there are 50,000. In 1783, there are 5,000 whites in that area. In 1790, there are 50,000. In 1800, there are 500,000. There's a demographic wave sweeping across. The ultimate resolution seems inevitable, Indian removal, which becomes the answer officially in 1830 under Jackson, though implemented gradually throughout the period. How could it have been avoided? Again, what's interesting, Washington, Jefferson, and Washington's Secretary of War, Henry Knox, all come together in 1790 and say, we cannot let this happen. The Indians have a natural right to their soil. They cannot be deprived of their rights without their consent. To do so is to violate the principles of the revolution as we understand it. And God knows if Washington doesn't understand it, who does? We've got to find a way to avoid that outcome. They come up with a new idea, which is still with us in some sense, that every Indian tribe of a substantial sort must be regarded as a sovereign nation, as independent and sovereign as Great Britain or France. That means the federal government, and most especially the executive branch, has jurisdiction over that decision. We will sign treaties with these sovereign nations, guaranteeing them certain land areas to create a series of 4 to 6 enclaves or homelands east of the Mississippi. We will guarantee that those are protected from white infringement, so the waves of white settlement must pass them by. Over time, they will either assimilate or they will appeal to come in as separate states, but they will be allowed to live their own Indian ways. They try this with a Creek Nation in 1790, and it's unenforceable. Knox says it would take 50,000 troops to defend the Creek Nation. Creek Nation's occupying pretty much modern-day Alabama. Washington says it would take a Chinese wall. It's the biggest disappointment and failure of the Washington presidency as far as Washington's concerned. Whereas with the slavery issue, it seems to me there's at least an increment of possibility it could have turned out differently. On this issue, I don't see how it could have. To some extent, once the Americans established themselves on the East Coast or the Atlantic Coast, and once especially the American colonists win the American Revolution, Native Americans are doomed. The biggest loser in the American Revolution is not Great Britain, which actually comes back in a very big way in the 19th century, to be sure. It's the Native Americans. I don't want to end on a negative note. I want to end on a positive note. What's the greatest moment at the founding? Ellis says the following. The moment the Washington decision to refrain, to step away from power. At the end of the war, up in Newburgh, New York, the Continental Army, then by about 15,000 strong, haven't got paid in a year and a half. Promises of a pension are clearly not going to be kept because the states are going to not keep their tax promises. So there's a rebellion brewing in the officer corps. Washington hears about it, calls a meeting of 502 officers. That's how many there are. And he basically says, what is this? And he said, they say, we intend to march on Philadelphia and declare you king. Washington takes these reading glasses out of his breast pocket and he puts them on. The men have never seen him wear reading glasses before. And he says, excuse me, gentlemen, but I have grown blind as well as gray in service to my country. The values which you are propagating are strange and new to me and represent a repudiation of what I believe I have fought for the last 8 years. That's the end of the mutiny. He goes down to Annapolis where the Continental Congress is temporarily meeting and in an elegant ceremony surrenders his sword, the commander-in-chief, gives up power. Think about it. Caesar didn't do it. Cromwell didn't do it. Napoleon didn't do it. Stalin didn't do it. Mao didn't do it. Castro hasn't done it. Musharraf isn't doing it. It's a remarkable thing. He's an aficionado of exits. He knows his own power will be increased by stepping away. There's a scene, there's a ball after the ceremony. The witness says, the ladies were lined up in rows to get a touch of him. This guy's 6'3 and a quarter, 202 pounds, a natural athlete, the best dancer in the room. He dances every dance. The horses are at the door. It's like a scene out of The Searchers in a John Ford Western. He's gone. It's the greatest exit in American history. Over in England, the American artist Benjamin West happens to be painting the portrait of George III at this very time. And West says to George III, sire, the word is that George Washington has rejected the crown. And George III says, really, if it's true, he will be the greatest man in the world. It was, and he was. Thank you very much. If you'd like to ask some questions, I will attempt to answer them at least for a brief period of time, and then we'll have a book signing for anyone who wants a book signed. By the way, remember that I have one child who still remains without a college education, and that any book purchased will contribute directly to the Alexander Ellis Scholarship Fund. See how unbelievably hapless I really am. Yes, okay, sir.
Let me just say, folks, for those of you who are new, the way we'll do it, and I see a lot of new faces, is that put your hand up. We will call on you. We'll try to get to as many as possible.
Okay.
Gentlemen in the white back there. One question each, please. Very direct.
Right. Thank you. I really enjoyed it. I just want to say before my question, my brother-in-law got me your book, Founding Brothers, and he was right. It gave me a very deep appreciation of the ideals and the importance of our country. And with regard to that, you started the speech with an analogy with regard to Iraq today and the Revolutionary War. and you gave an analogy about the insurgency. Do you see any analogy with regard to what we were fighting for, the Founding Brothers, with regard to the first time self-vote determination and really democracy, and perhaps...
No,
what,
no.
And
I don't
perhaps
want
a witch hunt. You see no analogy there? No,
only a limited analogy. I mean, I think that once your country's occupied by a foreign power, it galvanizes all kinds of sentiment. But to the extent that the violent core of the terrorist movement is rooted in sectarian conflicts among Sunnis and Shia and within people coming in from outside of a al-Qaeda dimension, there's nothing quite analogous to that in the United States. I do think that what did happen in America in the revolution, that's there was a lot of ethnic cleansing that went on in the American Revolution that is analogous to what's going on in Iraq. That the level of division within the populace between Whig, Tory, and people that wish to remain neutral was much sharper than we like to imagine. We like to imagine a kind of large, overwhelmingly Whiggish, patriotic population and then a sort of small Tory loyalist group. That's not true. That's not true. Like, what? How far is Valley Forge from here? 15 miles? Yeah, like, the reason the American Continental Army starves at Valley Forge in the summer of 77-78, the winter, is because the farmers sell their produce to the British rather than to the American colonists, I mean to the American Army. The British Army is flourishing in Philadelphia at that time, even though they got supply lines all the way back to England. If you took if you try to color code the countryside around Philadelphia at that moment, and sort of like red and blue, there would be a lot of purple. Depends on who's in control of the area. So the almost tribal character of war in Iraq is not totally different from what was happening back then. But there's nothing quite like... I think the central analogy is the predicament of the British. The predicament of a major, all-powerful military and attempting to establish and subjugate a population, which is almost impossible to do. Almost impossible to do. So he says.
Another question. Lady in the black, about seven rows back.
Hi, thank you for coming. One of my ancestors was a Hessian soldier. How many were there? What percentage of the British Army?
In the first strike force that comes across the Atlantic in the summer of 76, there's 32,000 troops. About half of them are Hessians. Okay? Now, after that, things get floating back and forth, and I'm not quite sure of the right numbers, but the Hessians represent only a minority of the total British force in country. And there are fights between the Hessian generals and the British generals on occasion, which mean people get replaced, etc. But when you say Hessian, there's a couple of different German principalities that are used to recruit these troops. And the colonists, the American patriots, hated the Hessians more than any other British troop. The Hessians were committed to no quarter. Most deaths in the American Revolution occur by disease. Four times as many people die of smallpox as die of combat wounds. But of those people that die of combat wounds, the largest percentage are people killed with a bayonet at close quarters. And the Hessians said, no quarter. We kill everybody on the ground. And that caused them to be hated.
Sorry about your relatives there.
Gentleman about 6-5 rows back here.
There seems to be a popular notion, or at least in my reading of history, a popular notion that the founders were driven by idealistic views to create a republic, when in fact, isn't it just as likely that they were lucky that the British were not so were overly stiff? George and the Tories were absolutely reluctant to give an inch, and had they given an inch, we might be part of the British Commonwealth of Nations today.
We probably would, but we would have up until somewhere in the 19th century. Yeah, the British handling of this in the 60s and 70s, 1760s and 70s, is probably the biggest blunder in the history of British statecraft. There wasn't any reason they needed to lose the colonies. As long as they kept them in the empire, some early version of a commonwealth idea was present there. But they didn't see it that way. I think the word I either agree with you or don't agree, because I'm not sure what you're saying. The word idealistic, Jefferson is idealistic. Most all the other founders are extremely realistic. I like to say Adams went to Harvard and Washington went to war, and they both learned the same lessons. Human nature is depraved. People don't do the right thing for the right reasons. You got to force them to do it. All utopian visions are inherently destructive and self-destructive, so that you don't have anything like the kind of mentality that exists in the French Revolution with Rousseau and Voltaire. These are very practical people who are, conservative revolutionaries. We have a kind of evolutionary revolution, which is one of the reasons it succeeds, in my judgment. Edmund Burke, Burkean Revolution, that's in some sense what it is, which is one of the reasons we still remain the oldest enduring republic in world history.
Another couple of questions. There's a gentleman all the way in the middle in the back in the red. Please wait for the mic, sir.
Yes, one of your emphasis is on what drove our revolution and our history is on these unusual founders, political geniuses. How would you rate as a factor in this history historians and other writers, and how much of an influence they may have had?
You mean at the time? Or since then?
Before then and at the time.
Before then, they had no influence whatsoever. There is, in the wake of the revolution's success, a kind of glorification process, both at the sort of adolescent level of, George Washington and Parson Weems kind of stories, and a kind of mythologization of the founders, which, by the way, Adams himself, who lived on until 1826, thought was horrible. So they're making me into some kind of marble saint, which I certainly wasn't. I think in the 19th century that iconic tradition continues. It then produces a backlash in the late 19th and early 20th century where sort of, like Charles Beard's economic interpretation of the Constitution basically says the founders really are just money men groveling after spoils. In the current context, most of the academic people, of which I am one, I am a card-carrying historian, PhD, Yale University, and most of them aren't writing about the founders. They're writing about, in this period, midwifery on the main frontier.
Actually, that's a good book, as a matter of fact. What kind of clothes they wore to demonstrations. And when they do write about the founders, they write about them in a pretty critical, hostile way. Sometimes as far as saying, these guys are the ones who created patriarchy, imperialism, racism, slavery, all the horrors of, you know, which of course is ridiculous, just as ridiculous as the other side of the story. And it's one of the reasons why I suggest to you that we need to begin to have, that the conversation up until fairly recently within the historical world has essentially been juvenile, adolescent. The greatest, the deadest, whitest males. It's like what their view of parents are, right? We got to get past that. We got to have an adult conversation. They're both. They are the greatest political generation in American history, and they're all flawed. And you can make different judgments about each of them. My harshest would be on Jefferson. My most positive would be on Washington. The one I love to have for a beer would be John Adams. The one I think is the wisest is your Franklin. Dirty old man that he was. But this notion that, and the, I'm playing off this, the profession of the within the groves of academe, see, either you ignore them or you diminish them. And what's happened over the last decade is all these people are writing these books that are selling these copies, and the profession doesn't know what to do. Partly because the profession is not interested in communicating with a larger public. The profession is only communicating with itself. We've got to get over that. I'm here as a living advertisement that you can do both things at the same time. You can check out my footnotes, but also, I think, read my prose. At least I hope so. That's what we ought to be doing, right? And give me a hand on that. I really believe it. I think I'll run for political office on that, despite my cleaning lady, right?
Folks, we've got time for one more. All the way in back, there's a gentleman in black with his hand up.
During your speech, you commented on slavery and how the Founding Fathers' lack of dealing with the issue is one of the greatest tragedies in the framing of the Constitution. And my question is that if the Founding Fathers found a way to get rid of the establishment of slavery, would the following rights of the Civil Rights Movement, would that have created a problem that would have created too big of a problem for a new government to establish and overcome, and would that just tear apart everything that they're trying to accomplish?
We can't go back and play the clock, you know, run the tape again, but my own judgment is if they had found a way to end slavery gradually in the late 18th century, then we wouldn't have had to have a civil war. Two things would have happened. One, the black population of the United States as currently constituted would be about one quarter of what it is now, because they would have sent the population elsewhere. Two, the civil rights movement would have happened earlier in the 20th century. That we wouldn't have had to wait for the end of slavery for that to happen. It would have begun the process of recognition that it wasn't just slavery itself, but racial inequality that was a violation of the revolution. And remember, Martin Luther King stands on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963 and says, Jefferson has issued a promissory note, which we're cashing in. And so all of those end of slavery, civil rights, women's suffrage, gay rights, all go back to the revolutionary moment. And when the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, that
gay marriage could not be prohibited, the central citation was the preface to the Massachusetts Constitution, written by Adams. Actually, Adams wrote the whole Constitution, as a matter of fact, which, you know, mimics the language of the Declaration. And you ask a question, did John Adams think that in writing those words that he was endorsing gay marriage? Of course not. But there they are. There they are. And they allow each generation to decide what they mean. Thank you very much.
Where do I go?
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.